Let me introduce Professor Feliciano. Professor Feliciano is one of the three authors of the Bible of Trauma by Moore, by Feliciano, and by Maddox. And he is the professor of surgery at the University of Maryland School of Medicine and practices at the Shock Trauma Center. Thank you, Dr. Feliciano.
Thank you, Professor. Good afternoon. I am not Ken Maddox. I'm going to talk to you about exposure of the carotid artery and jugular vein, and I will throw in a few other comments because exposure techniques, as you know, are relatively limited, certainly in zone two. I'm going to talk just briefly about incidence, and I'll skip over diagnosis and then get to exposure and treatment. These are relatively rare, even in the busiest trauma centers, presumably because some of the patients exsanguinate on the street, some stroke immediately, and it's only those who are tamponaded or who get rapid EMS care who will survive to reach the hospital. The hard signs of carotid artery injury, in particular in the neck, are exactly the same hard signs as you would get in the extremity. It's really word for word. The patients present a variety of ways. This is a close-range shotgun wound in which arterial bleeding was coming out of the suprasternal notch. You can see there were a variety of incisions used there, but we were able to save this patient, as I'll show you a little later. A lot of the patients who make it to the hospital have these large pulsatile hematomas. Sometimes, even if it's not pulsatile, it can still be an arterial hematoma related to a carotid artery injury in zone two. I do want to emphasize one thing for those of you who don't do much trauma, and that is if the patient has a tamponaded hematoma, or if somebody's been able to get their finger in the dike and stop the carotid artery from exsanguinating, it's really important to get an airway in these patients in the emergency room, because if it's a pulsatile hematoma, it pushes the bottom of the mouth up and pretty much occludes the whole airway much quicker than you would think it could happen. So if your patient is asphyxiating in the emergency room and you've got a big hematoma and somebody has tried to intubate and it really doesn't work, go right to cricothyroidotomy. It's in the midline. Hematomas often don't cross over the midline way up high. If you have the rare patient with intraoral hemorrhage, don't let them exsanguinate or aspirate. Get your finger in there, see where the bleeding's coming from. Stuff the mouth with gauze. If you have to, put a Foley balloon catheter where you see the bleeding coming from. And finally, with external hemorrhage, again, obviously have somebody put a finger in the dike and get the patient intubated quickly so they don't asphyxiate from deviation of the trachea. These are the famous zones of the neck by Monson, Jack Saletta, and Bob Freyark. Jack Saletta just died last year. Bob Freyark died in 2006. This is the original description of the zones of the neck. As many of you know, 10 years later, it was theoretically revised by the people at San Francisco General, and zone one moved up to the cricoid. I don't think that's of any advantage to change the original zones. The bottom line for those of you who don't do much trauma is zone one is hard to get to and may require a thoracotomy or a sternotomy. Zone two is easy to get to, which explains all the negative neck expirations we've had in the past, because it's so easy to operate and find nothing. And zone three is incredibly hard to get to. Bottom line is zone one and zone three, you really need overt evidence before you operate. And here's a classic example. This is a zone one injury. A patient stabbed in the thoracic inlet, completely stable, really a relatively unremarkable x-ray, a traditional in those days angiogram, and there's a 5 centimeter aneurysm, pseudoaneurysm, if you will, off the base of the right common carotid artery. So just because a patient doesn't have overt bleeding from the site, doesn't have a grossly abnormal x-ray, think about it a little bit and say, well, all the connections to the head come through the thoracic inlet. How can something not be injured? So zone one is a good place to study, as is zone three. Operative control of hemorrhage. Incisions of choice are as listed. For anything really in zone one where you've got bleeding from the inlet or you've got angiographic evidence of an injury down in the superior mediastinum, you traditionally add the median sternotomy. And then if you need the neck extension, we'll show that in just a minute. Zone 2 is the classic oblique cervical incision, which in general allow you to get proximal and distal control of a common carotid below and the internal and external above. And zone 3 is just damn hard to get to, and I'm going to illustrate what I think you should do for these extraordinarily rare injuries. I am going to show some figures from Bob Rutherford's textbook. Bob is one of my personal heroes, just died a couple years ago, and really wrote so many good things in textbooks about how to expose and how to repair that I, if you will, I'm going to dedicate part of this lecture to him. In zone 1, if you do a sternotomy, the first thing you're going to run into with either carotid artery is the crossover innominate vein. I have seen many people transect this vein, which sort of is okay. It's a little bit like transecting the left renal vein in the abdomen, but it does pose some problems for patients later in life when somebody wants to put in a TPN line or a central venous line, or they need angio access on that side. So in general, if you ligate some of the collateral branches of the crossover vein, you can usually mobilize it and get to the base of the right common carotid or left common carotid with relative ease. Excuse me. One of the things I like about Bob Rutherford's book is he used his own profile in some of the drawings. And this is a classic example of the patient with a transverse roll under the shoulders, the neck super extended, and the the oblique incision along the anterior border of the sternocleidomastoid muscle. And again, if you have a giant hematoma, you have to decide, based on your experience, if the hematoma is too close to the thoracic inlet, whether you're going to need to do a median sternotomy. But in general, those hematomas in the neck usually allow you to get proximal control if you know how to do what I'm going to show you in the next few slides. When you make these oblique cervical incisions, and apropos what I just said, if the hematoma is really here, you don't have to make the whole oblique cervical incision to start with, right? Gene mentioned the two-incision approach for popliteal. Well, you can actually, you know, make a much shorter version of this right above the clavicle and get proximal control, perhaps then get distal control, and then open the hematoma as we do in peripheral vascular trauma. The first thing you see if you make the whole cervical oblique incision is, of course, the jugular vein, which crosses over everything, and the facial vein is that transverse thing. The facial vein can always be ligated and divided. The ideal approach to the carotid is really over this, as illustrated in the figure, where you skip and not get too involved with the jugular, it's not actively bleeding, and get right down to the carotid. In many areas of the body, if you do extensive mobilization of the vein first, it's fine, but it takes time and it gets in your way unless you put an umbilical tape around. So the direct approach is, as illustrated there, go right to the artery if you can without a lot of venous dissection. This is really the most important figure. You can see the jugular vein being pulled over to your left. The carotid artery, the base common carotid, is looped with the vessel loop. The internal carotid and then the external carotid. And then you can see the vagus in the back between the jugular and the carotid. And you can see the ansa hypoglossi immediately there. When you loop the external carotid, you may end up looping some of the first branches like the thyroid. But basically, once you get proximal control, you ought to be able to get pretty good exposure all the way up quickly because there are rarely any adhesions there in the absence of prior surgery. And you don't have any other anatomical structures to worry about until you get to the apex of the neck superiorly, where you have your crossover hypoglossal nerve. So you have some freedom to really move quickly here and get distal control once you have your proximal clamp on. Now, zone 3 is a real problem because the internal carotid artery in zone 3 is behind the mandible, and you cannot get a finger behind somebody's mandible. And on the rarest of occasions, you're going to have a patient who's exsanguinating at the base of the skull, sort of at the junction of zone 2 and zone 3. And you can try a finger, but a finger often doesn't do a very good job at that level, occluding the whole track. and you simply are going to have to either try a Foley or a Fogarty catheter. And the way you do this is the way you do it in some other locations in the body. Put the balloon catheter in, a sonometer or two, blow up the balloon, did the bleeding stop? Yes, no. No, deflate the balloon, advance it a sonometer, blow it up, did the balloon stop or not? Once you get control of the internal carotid behind the mandible using the balloon, leave the balloon inflated, and then that's another whole lecture about what you should do next, because you're getting to the upper reaches of the internal carotid artery, and obviously 7 to 10% of patients do not have a complete circle of Willis. Another whole lecture, if you will. Here's another patient, a little higher stab wound, exsanguinating hemorrhage. We just used, again, a balloon catheter and then stuffed the bullet track with some gauze to acutely control hemorrhage and then decide if we were going to operate, whether we were going to stent, whether we're going to do an angiogram to see if there's crossover flow, et cetera. Now, if you, on the rarest of occasions, have to get to zone three, it's not a very quick thing, and the two approaches are as listed, where the oral surgeon is paged stat to the operating room, something they're not used to. They're asked to subluxate the temporomandibular joint, and a good oral surgery team can actually keep the TM joint sublux by putting interdental wires on in about 10 minutes. And the people from Parkland have described this in the past, and I'll illustrate it for you in just a second. Perhaps a better approach was described some years later, the so-called vertical ramus osteotomy. And again, this is the rarest of patients in whom the endovascular people feel they do not have enough time to get up there, or technically they can't get up there, or they're not available, or they don't know how to do this. And you, as the trauma surgeon, say, I've got to expose the internal carotid artery in zone three. This is a patient, obviously a TM joint subluxed on the right. It doesn't have to be fully dislocated, which is better for the patients because then they don't have chronic TM problems later. And interdental wiring, when you have older patients who are edentulous, you have to get a bit more innovative with your wiring. But this moves the mandible away from the internal carotid to allow you to get exposure. This is the bony incision, if you will, for vertical ramus osteotomy. Needless to say, you have to know where to make your skin incision over this, try and avoid the mandibular branch of the facial nerve. Obviously, it entails a lot of dissection by your oral surgery team. But once you do a vertical ramus osteotomy, the two fragments can be separated anterior and posteriorly, and you can get to the carotid artery, the internal carotid at the base of the skull. Operative repair of the carotid artery once you get a good exposure is as listed. It is the standard repairs for any arteries in the body. The caveats are, for major common carotid artery, do you need to shunt? No. You ought to be able to put in a graft in about 10 minutes. You ought to be able to do an end-end in about 5 minutes. If you have an internal carotid artery injury, the vessels are much smaller. Particularly in women, I would not recommend a PTFE graft. And in these patients, obviously, you would have ahead of time been smart enough to prep the ipsilateral groin so that you could retrieve the autogenous saphenous vein. If you have wounds at the bifurcation that mainly take off part of the wall, it's annoying to have to replace the old bifurcation. And there are rare occasions in which you can simply lay a so-called thin-walled PTFE patch covering the origin of the internal, the external, and the common as well. If you're really high in the neck and it took you a while to get there and you're wondering how you're going to get it all reconstructed, I just shun it. I've had a couple occasions where my ego ran amok and I said, oh, I can fix this thing. I can somehow get a clamp distally. And 45 minutes later, I was still struggling with a leaky anastomosis. I think on occasion you may want to decide if you have good enough exposure, enough help, enough experience to do this quickly. If not, get a shunt in and then get the kind of help you need to get a graft in at the highest levels, but still beneath the base of the skull. This is a classic example. This is the man I showed you earlier in the lecture with the shotgun wound. He was exsanguinating. I went in through the neck because I thought he was going to exsanguinate before I did the sternotomy. And much to my chagrin, the wound was right above the bifurcation of the innominate. But, you know, it's sort of the rule of Darwin here in trauma. If the patient's still alive, it's probably a hole that you can get your finger on or a clamp under. And we were able to get a Sutinski right under all this and just attach the right common carotid artery, debride the wound, and then replant it back in, all through a neck incision. But in any other case, I think if somebody had been able to get their finger down there, we would have added a sternotomy. Again, with a common carotid artery, you can put anything in it. The bottom line is, if you have a simultaneous trachea or esophageal injury, I think it's really worthwhile to detach the sternal head of the sternocleidomastoid and swing it over your graft and somehow separate the dirty tracheal repair, or even worse, the dirty esophageal repair, and keep that graft covered with good muscle in case you get a few air bubbles out of the trachea or you get the 10% esophageal leak in the neck. So any kind of graft is great for the common carotid. Once you have a combined trachea and or esophagus with the carotid, keep your graft covered, whether it's PTFE or an autogenous saphenous vein. Kenji asked me to speak briefly about the internal jugular vein. I think the reason he asked me to do that is he wanted me to quote his paper, so I will do that for you here. Does the jugular vein with a hole in it create a lot of havoc for patients? Well, sure, if it's a giant hole, but it's pretty clear in this era of helical CT of a lot of patients, as stated in this paper by Kenji and Dimitri at USC, that there are patients who have internal jugular vein injuries who are not bleeding to death, they are not asphyxiating, they have a stable hematoma, and in this particular study, in these stable patients, they didn't operate on them, even though they saw a hole in the vein on CT. The length of stay for these patients was a couple days. All patients healed without operation. And Kenji, I want a check in the mail for mentioning this damn paper. Operative management of the bad jugular vein injury is pretty straightforward. For wall defects, if you can get a Sutinski under it, go ahead and fix it transversely. Hopefully, I don't think we agonize much about narrowing the jugular vein. If you're going to ask me, have I ever seen a pulmonary embolus from a narrow jugular vein repair, I have not. If somebody has one, they can come and grab me later. With a big defect or combined carotid jugular injuries, it is okay to ligate one. Every textbook, including our own, states that if you have a transverse cervical wound that takes out both jugulars, it'd probably be nice to repair one of them rather than ligate both to avoid pseudotumor cerebri. These kind of injuries involving both sides of the neck with vascular injuries are incredibly rare, and I'm just repeating what the textbooks say, that it's probably good to have at least one of your jugular veins empty. This is a classic example of a patient in whom the jugular was the main structure injured, a big hematoma, non-pulsatile. And it's really hard to see with the glare in here, but the most superior aspect there, the jugular vein has been ligated. Bottom line for carotids, get an airway in quickly, even before you go to the operating room. Secondly, make a decision on whether you can get this in zone two, or whether based on your lack of experience or your concern that you may not be able to get proximal control through a little keyhole incision above the clavicle, add the sternotomy. Always repair the carotid if you can, for obvious reasons. God did not like that vessel to be ligated. It's exactly the same as the proximal SMA, or as Dimitri said, the proximal or distal iliac arteries. Thanks very much for your attention.